Good afternoon and welcome to one and all. Wonderful to have the opportunity to do some learning with all of you today. Let me begin with a couple of public service announcements. First of all, I want to thank our sponsors. Torah in Motion's Learning is sponsored today by Adam Dicker in loving memory of his father, Zachary J. Dicker, Zacharia ben Shimshon Zal. May his memory be a blessing. And Torah in Motion's Learning today is sponsored as well by Donna Glassman, Alan Wellman, and family in loving memory of Donna's father, Yechiel ben Yechiel Issy Glassman Zal. May his memory be a blessing. And thank you to the wonderful folks at Torah in Motion for making all of this possible. I have posted the sources in the chat. I'll post them again a little later on if anyone didn't get them, to be sure that we're all on the same page. And just a reminder that next week will be the final meeting of this four-part series. If you've missed any of the pieces, they're all available online on the Torah in Motion website. And please God, next week is really the grand finale. We'll try to tie things together and answer the $64,000 question. What is it? What are the elements that made the Shulchan Aruch the enduring code of Jewish law for the last 500 years? But today we're going to leave Safed and take a detour to Krakow, to the land of Poland, in a contemporaneous time, and we'll be talking about Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramah. And then next week, we'll, again, as I mentioned, try to tie things back together with the publication of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah together. Okay, and we'll try to leave some time for questions at the end. So feel free to post questions in the chat, or we'll leave time at the end for questions. So let's begin with a little bit of biographical background, and then we'll get into Rav Moshe Isserles' contribution to the Shulchan Aruch and to the world of Ashkenazic Jewish thought. So Rav Moshe Isserles was born in Krakow, Poland, in 1530. The city of Krakow in 16th century. In the 16th century, is a prominent, home to a prominent and well-established Jewish community, and Rav Moshe Isserles is born into this prominent and quite wealthy family. He studied in Lublin under a man whose name is not well known, called Rabbi Shalom Shachnow, who would later become the Ramah's father-in-law. And Rav Shalom Shachnow was also the teacher of Rav Shlomo Luria, the Maharshal, and Chaim ben Bezalel, who we'll talk about a little later on today. He didn't leave anything in writing, and as a result, his name is not as well known as perhaps it should be. But one can only imagine what it means to be the teacher of someone like Rav Moshe Isserles. In 1550, at age 20, Rav Moshe Isserles returns from Lublin to Krakow, and he establishes a yeshiva. And this is really almost sui generis. You could probably count on one hand the cases we have like this over the course of Jewish history. But you think of the yeshiva and the Rosh Yeshiva, and they're generally totally dependent on the support of the community. You know, we have rabbinic contracts from the 17th and 18th centuries, and you see that the community makes an arrangement with the rabbi. You know, we'll hire you and we'll agree to support 8 students. Right? It's the burden of the community. In the case of Rav Moshe Isserles in 1550 Krakow, he supports not only himself, but also his own students in his yeshiva. Okay. So that's a kind of fascinating, you know, model for how one can attract and retain and maintain students. Kesef yana es hakol, right? If you can't pay for the lunch of the students, you're not going to be able to maintain a yeshiva. If you can house them and feed them and maintain them, so that is obviously a super successful model. But I don't mean to minimize the Ramah's learning. It happened to be he was a wealthy man, But of course, what attracted his students was his prowess in the field of rabbinics and Talmud. At the age of 23, which is a young age, he was appointed as a dayan, and he also served on the Council of Four Lands, which is maybe a topic for another conversation. But the Council of Four Lands was a supra-communal legislative body, predominantly lay-led, but also had a rabbinic wing that was responsible for arbitrating disputes between and among communities or between rabbis and communities, dealing with issues of loans between and among Jews, bankruptcy. So these intra-communal issues, supra-communal issues, Council of the Four Lands, and the Ramah is involved in the Council of the Four Lands. So Moshe Tzulis is a halachist and a Talmudist. He's also a Kabbalist, and he's also quite knowledgeable in secular fields like history, astronomy, and philosophy. Okay. It doesn't take long before the Ramah earns a reputation as the leading posek of his generation. Even though he lives a very, very short life, he dies on May 1st, 1572. And for interest's sake, we have his tombstone. Some of you have surely visited the city of Krakow and the Jewish quarter in Kazimierz. And you can visit the Ramah's shul adjacent to the cemetery in which he is buried. On the tombstone, just to read the second half, the end of the third line describing Rav Moshe Isserles, the tombstone reads, Harbitz Torah b'Yisrael. He spread Torah throughout Israel. Hamid Talmidim l'Ravos Alfei Yisrael. He had thousands of students. And here's the kicker, the key line, Mi Moshe v'ad Moshe lokam ki Moshe b'Yisrael. So they used to say this about the Rambam, that from Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe ben Maimon, until Maimonides, there was never a Moshe. Okay, so that's pretty good if you're compared to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, so now, 500 years later, it gets extended, and the Jews of Krakow write about Moshe Isserles, Mi Moshe v'ad Moshe lokam ki Moshe b'Yisrael. From Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe Isserles, there's never been such a gaon, such a Torah giant. What an extraordinary person. Okay, so what was the Ramah's relationship with Rav Yosef Karo? We have these two parallel worlds, and we'll talk more about them in a moment. But you have the world, just for ease of simplicity, and we'll define these terms a little more clearly in a moment. But you have the world of Sfarad, and we already established Rav Yosef Karo is the Gadol Hador, and everyone turns to him, and there's nobody great. He's in Sfat. And here in Ashkenaz, you have this younger, very talented, very scholarly, very popular man called Rav Moshe Isserles, who is the posek for the Jews of Ashkenaz. So did they know about each other? Did they interact with one another? Did they have some kind of relationship? Okay. So, you know, just to put it in context, so Moshe Isserles in 1550 is a very young man, but he's already the head of a yeshiva in Krakow at the age of 20. So Rav Yosef Karo is already 60 something by that time. He's old enough to be father or maybe even grandfather of Rav Moshe Isserles, but they're both gedolim. Do they know about each other, living all these hundreds of miles away? So there's one correspondence which is recorded in the Shilos and Shuvos of the Ramah, the responsa of the Ramah, in which to the untrained eye it appears as though Rav Moshe Isserles and Rav Yosef Karo corresponded. Okay. However, a closer look at what's happening in the text itself reveals that is not, in fact, the case. Okay. For anyone who doesn't have the sources, I'm just going to repost them in the chat. So everyone should have access, but I'll also share this on the screen with you now, and just say something about the nature of response to literature at this time and more generally. So what does it mean to have a responsum? So typically, a junior rabbi will write a letter to a more senior rabbi and say, you know, this particular question was asked to me by someone in my community. I'm not really sure what the answer is. Here's what I think, and I'm wondering if you agree with me, if you could shed some light on it, and could you issue a psak? Could you issue a formal halachic ruling so that I can reply to my local community member? And that's sort of the typical frame in which a responsum would get asked and answered. However, sometimes there would be another layer of complexity to the correspondence. Somebody might say, I was asked the following question, and I consulted with a couple of different local rabbis, or I consulted with a couple of less than local rabbis. I wrote to them. Here are the answers that I received. What do you think? And now you have 11 people involved in a particular question. And something like this happened in one of the correspondences, which is recorded in a book called Shu'at Rama, the Shailos and Tshuvos, the Responsa of Moshe Israelis, which was a collection of his correspondence, the answers that he gave to halachic querists over the course of his lifetime. So have a look, if you will, at source number 2. The Rama received the following question, and the details are not that important for our purposes. Source number 2, the Rama was asked the following question: Lamadnu Rabbeinu Ruvein Chole Venatalamus Bekodem Tirasot Zivala Se Sachmal Ani Eretz Yisrael Besachmal Achiv Umeis Az VeChayim LeChol Yisrael Shavak. This particular person was on his deathbed, and he made a deathbed declaration, and he said, I have assets, and I want them to be split up among two groups. One, I want to support the indigent Jews of Israel, and two, I want to support my family. Okay? So some of the money is left to charity, and some of it is left to heirs. And sure enough, the person passes away. And wouldn't you know it, there's a dispute, and the heirs say it wasn't a real thing. We contest the validity of that deathbed declaration. In point of fact, the assets should all belong to us, the heirs, and we're not sending any of the money to the indigent Jews of Israel. And who did they turn to and ask this question to? So you're holding this book in your hand and you're reading the Shailos and Tshuvos of the Rama. So it seems like, right, who would be answering this question? The Rama, except if you keep reading, look what happens. The tshuva that is recorded here is actually not written by the Rama. But let's look at the answer first, and then we'll continue. Again, without getting into all of the details, just jump to the next parak. Nimtza debenido didan zacho ani eretz Yisrael v'mashit zibal aseis ani eretz Yisrael v'matnas bari. This was the person responding to this query says, this is totally legitimate. This is not a last will and testament, but if I'm of sound mind and body and I hold up a $100 bill and I say, I hereby designate this $100 to a particular institution who supports, poor people in Israel. So that's it. That's a perfectly valid declaration. And that $100 doesn't belong to me anymore. I now have a debt to pay the pledge that I just made. So who had written this responsum? Jump to the end of the second paragraph. V'im heyos hadvarim pshutim nidrashti l'asher sha'aluni ne'um hatzir Yosef Karo. The question had been asked to Rabbi Yosef Karo, and he paskened, and he gave his answer, and he said the indigent people of Eretz Yisrael are owed this money. Now someone turned around and forwarded the question and the answer to Rav Moshe Israelis. And they said, we had this question. We asked Rabbi Yosef Karo. Here's his answer. What do you think? And now this is really fascinating and really telling for a couple of reasons. Okay, so now Rav Moshe Isserles is in receipt of the question and the answer already provided by Rav Yosef Karo, Gadol Hador in Tzfat. And maybe just from a parenthetical perspective, maybe Rav Yosef Karo also had a special appreciation for the needs of the indigent of Eretz Yisrael, considering that he was living there. Okay. So now Rav Moshe Isserles responds, Is Batil Hashid Mehakavod Lidivri Hagaon Hagadol Marina Verabeni Yosef Karo. So if you read this quickly, it looks like Rav Moshe Isserles is writing a letter to Rav Yosef Karo. That's not actually what's happening here. They never corresponded. There's no evidence that we have that they corresponded directly. Rav Moshe Isserles is in fact reporting on the piece of paper that he's reading with the response of Rav Yosef Karo. So he says, I'm now in receipt of Rav Yosef Karo's tshuva. And I just want to let you know who he is and what I think of him. Rav Yosef Karo, it's an amazing paragraph. Asher meimav anu shosim mikan kano bekado. We drink his water. Ma'usif b'shivcho lechado. I can't possibly overstate how much praise and how much honor he is owed. Mi'achar dechol ma'ad at mishabech le'at megenes b'masi yado. Like, it would just detract. Like, he's so extraordinary. There's nothing more I could say about him. Yivarcheu Hashem b'nafsho u'mi'udo. He should just be blessed in all ways possible. V'yoso ki'achar ha'shevach ra'ul yos ha'tfila. And as the Talmud says, right after the Shevach, so then comes the prayer, the supplication. So he says, I'll do it. I'll kain espalel Hashem. I also offer up its tefillah. Al hasid laharich yemei morenu verabenu. Hashem should extend the life and the days of our teacher and our rabbi, Nisi Elokim besochenu, a prince of a man, a godly man in our midst. Vishnosab betov v'ne'imim livlos ad b'shuv Hashem shivat zion yira ina ve'inenu. He should live and be well. Okay. And then the Rama goes on to say, I actually have a different conclusion, and I disagree with what Rabbi Yosef Karo says. I think it actually wasn't a proper declaration, and he makes an argument as to why the heirs should really receive the funds. Okay, a separate topic for another time, but I just wanted to share this with you, A, to clear the record and to just be absolutely clear that there was no direct correspondence that we have between Rav Moshe Isserles and Rav Yosef Karo, and to give you a sense of the esteem in which Rav Yosef Karo was held by Rav Moshe Isserles. So what did Rav Moshe Isserles contribute to the world of halacha, and what did he contribute to the world of Ashkenazic halacha specifically? The book that we're going to focus on today is the Rama's book called the Darkei Moshe. And I want to sort of jump right in without giving away too much, because Rav Moshe Isserles in his introduction actually tells us the kind of history of how this book came about and how it came about in reference to or relative to the works of Rav Yosef Karo, right, living in Tzfat contemporaneously with Rav Moshe Isserles in Krakow. Okay. So let's jump in. If you have the sources in front of you, so a very lengthy introduction to the Darkei Moshe, I have for you excerpted in source number 4 on your source sheet. Okay, and I just want to share with you a few highlights where the Rama tells us how the book came about and what his goals and ambitions are. Why did you write this text? What are you trying to accomplish? Okay. So first of all, he says in the first bold, he says, Ula olam shivisi neged einai divrei hakadmonim, divrei hagimara vehageonim. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but the Rama is also a poet, okay, and writes in this kind of beautiful and lyrical style, which is totally lost in translation. But everything is a riff on a pasuk or a Talmudic a saying, and everything is a rhyme, and just from a literary perspective, you could spend a long time studying this this text for all of the allusions and all of the rhetoric. It's really quite something. So again, I could stop myself every time, you know, I kind of catch one of the thousand references, even though I'm probably only attuned to a fraction of them. But in the interest of time, I'll share with you more the substance than the form. L'olam shivisi neged einai divrei hakadmonim, divrei hagemara vehageonim. I always keep in front of me, when I'm writing this book, I always keep in front of me the following sources. I have the words of my predecessors. I have the Gemara and the Gaonim. V'harif, v'hatosfos, v'harambam, haposkim harishonim. And what we would call the medieval commentaries, the important commentaries, the Rabbeinu Alfasi and the Tosafists and the Rambam, v'hamordechai, v'ashri, v'hatur, hema ha'achronim. Okay, and he considers these Ashkenazic poskim a little later, the next generation, the Mordechai and the Ashri, the Tur, those are all Ashkenazim. Ki hema ba'u lefanai v'lifnim. Okay, they're my predecessors. I have to bow to them. Uvarosh kol mechabrim hema nimnim. These are considered to be the giants. V'af ki hema poskim shepashtu b'chol agola, v'zos taras ha'ola alibi b'rishona, v'horos achar divrehem la'adas mi mana. And again, it's all rhymed and beautiful. And again, if I put it in a different format, you'd see how it all lines up in, I don't know, pentameter. There's a system to this lyricism, and it's quite beautiful. But again, to the substance, he wants you to know that these are the major poskim. We have to acknowledge them, and we have to incorporate them into any halachic discussion that we might have. Let's jump ahead to the next bolded paragraph. The paragraph beginning with the words Uvaruf. He says, V'agav grara amru li rayonai, v'chizayon davar chachma leneged einai, l'kot kol chidushai haposkim biyachad. You know, I'm learning and I'm teaching and I'm studying in my yeshiva, and I have all these sfarim out in front of me, and I have all these books and all these poskim, and it occurred to me that what I could do is a service to the community to collect the important contributions of each of these poskim, kidei shiyu biyadi ke'achad, so that they'd all be in one place. Okay? So sometimes, you know, a few poskim arrive at the same conclusion, so I don't need to know all of them, but if one of them has a chiddush and somebody has something novel to say, so I could put that in one spot, and then on the next page would be somebody else's a contribution, and would all be gathered together as an anthology. Lekosvan lezikaron b'tzad eze posik echad, and my goal was to incorporate them as a kind of commentaries, a little bit the wrong word, but an accompanying text alongside an existing commentary that would give more flavor, more context, more background, more substance to the text that you would be studying. And this was the Ashkenazic tradition. This should sound familiar, because the Beis Yosef described his desire to do something very similar and arrived at a similar conclusion, that the best place to start this project would be the text of the Arba Turim, the text of the Tur. So the Rama says that this was my goal. I was going to take the Tur and I was going to write again, it's a little imprecise, but I'm going to write a commentary to the Tur, an anthology that could accompany the Tur. Ki divrayam beseder na'em esudarim, uvakalef sharlim tzobom, uvoksho af echad min ha-mevoarim, hein zekenim hem narim, v'ayidei zeh ha-yu ha-dvarim b'libit tfunim shimurim. I'd have a monument to all of my research and to all of my work. Everything that I compiled from these earlier sources would be in one place. Umiyad es masni azarti mishnas tirdamti ninarti meezer yoshev tehilos neazarti. So he goes on and describes that something happened, and he's shaken, and he's trembling, and he almost, you know, can't understand what's happening. He says, I almost fell off my chair because I'm involved in this process. You can imagine this is a serious undertaking, right? This wasn't like, okay, next week I'm going to work on it. No, this is going to be a years long endeavor to do something which he believes will be revolutionary, extraordinary, and meaningful contribution to the halachic system. And he says, and this is good because Purim is coming, so you have an excerpt from the Megillah. The Rama wrote a whole book as a parish to the Megillah. He says, I'm in the middle of this project. I'm working and I'm working. Uvehagia Torester, Rotzilomer Ister Behetzer. So it's like a play on words, another one. He says, I got to Ister Beheter. I'm writing about issues in Yoredeya, what's permitted and what's not permitted, and what's kosher and what's not kosher.
The word Tor here is with a tet, and the original is yes. On top. So he's also Romez here to the Tor of Shulchan Aruch.
Yes, 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 exactly. Thank you. Right, the excerpt is from when Esther is about to approach. It's her turn to approach Achashverosh. She's in the Tor. She's in the line with the top, and the Rama switch right. Hagia Tor Esther. Right. So the Isser Beheter in the Arba Turim. Everything's a code. And I got there, v'yisachalti hilchos chala, and I'm up to the halachas of chala, achazni, and you forgive me if I'm getting the grammar wrong here, because it's quite complex. Achazni pilatzos vilivshani chalchala. Right. B'shimi ner Yisrael rosh hagola. Ari misavcho ala. El hashamayim v'ruach alehem kedishin b'chafno asa. V'chiber sefer beis yosef. He says, oh my God, I got word that the Gadol Hador, no one less than Reb Yosef Karo in Tzfat, published his Beis Yosef. Asher kol ro'av yida'on esmalaso. Everyone knows he's the greatest. Ves tovo v'rov tov ha'tzafon b'kirbo. Az nivhalti p'shepol harek pa'alti. I was beside myself. I thought everything I've done is now in vain. Okay, just imagine as a kind of banal example. So you're a graduate student and you're writing your doctoral dissertation and maybe you're writing your first book and you're like 800 pages in and then you hear that the most prominent person in your field in the world just published the authoritative text on your topic. Like, oh my gosh, I'm crushed. I'm devastated. Like, what am I left with? Like, the Beis Yosef beat me to the punch. And it's not just like, oh, I had a friendly competition with one of my, local colleagues, and he has his book and I'll have my book. No, it's Reb Yosef Karo, who again is a generation and a half older than established, known, reputed, the God of the Torah. Everybody knows Reb Yosef Karo. Shiagati Larik Ulavahala Vishinasi Bahina Mi Meni Gazalti is like, how much sleep did I lose over this? Vilhaneor Haze Hispalti ki divre neged chachamanal ke'enech shavo vishraga betzihara my man. What am I gonna do? It's almost like we have an English idiom that's almost the same. Like, I can't hold a candle to the Gadol Hador. So everything I worked for, I'm crushed and I'm devastated. And then he goes on and he says he rediscovered his composure, and he discovered that he does have a contribution to make and that all his efforts were not in fact in vain, and it was his goal to publish this book called the Dark Emoshe, and there was still some utility in this project. So, again, in the interest of time, I'll just summarize some of these points. It's a very long introduction. You're welcome to study it more thoroughly. But first of all, he says, Ha'echad l'havi kol dvarim below or echatzav. So he says, first of all, I want to be concise and I want to be short. So the Beis Yosef, as we know, and again, you just kind of take the Shulchan Aruch out of your mind, because this is being written at a time where the Beis Yosef is published, but we haven't gotten to the Shulchan Aruch yet. So the Dark Yamash comes back and says, you know, the Beis Yosef is very lengthy, right? There's a lot of material in there. And that's going to be a tall order for someone who wants to go through everything and to know everything. So I'm going to do one step better again, with due respect to Rabbi Yosef, but I'm going to do one step better because I'm going to be shorter and I'm going to be concise. Okay. Says, the next point, he says, the next bolded paragraph, Od kasafti harbe tshuvos ka'onim, tshuvos achronim, tshuvos mahariv, v'diver yisr v'hetzer arch, sher lo yichazvu meimav, v'machaber yisyosef lo ra'u meimav. He says, I'm also going to call on books that Rabbi Yosef Karo never heard of, right? There's Ashkenazic books that are known to us Jews here in Krakow. Rabbi Yosef Karo doesn't have them, okay? Because he's living, you know, how many miles away in Tzfat. So there's going to be some added benefit to my book because my book is going to be actually more comprehensive because there's these books that Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't have access to. And third, he says, "Hashlishis v'hu aikar," and this is the main point. He says, "V'hu atachlis hamukash b'zeh mechkar." This is really the main thing. Ki adu asharav ha'machaber b'Yis Yosef b'tivo ha'gdolim nichsav. He says, "Everybody knows that famous system that the Beis Yosef talked about in his introduction." Pasuk alacha b'chol makom al pi shnei v'shlosha edim. You have the Rif and the Rambam and the Rush, and it's a vote. It's like a Beis Din. And Rabbi Yosef Karo says, as long as I have two out of three, so that's the path that I will follow. Right? Hey, ma'agonim, nachmanim, harif, harambam, harash, b'chol makom, sheshnayim, ahem, ledas, achas, nitzpadim, ulashar, ravusa, adira, etara, lo chashale. So the Rama says, that comes at an expense. It's beautiful. You have the Rush and the Rambam and the Rif. But what about everybody else? Right? There's probably dozens, if not hundreds, of other important halachic authorities that the Beis Yosef is functionally ignoring by just paskening two out of three Rambam Rif Rush. Okay. So he goes on to say, that I have another governing principle that I want to bring to the table. Rak b'makom gedolim amud lefsok halacha kidivrei shneim. V'af ki hem kamai v'lo basrai v'lo chash kidivreim shetzavchu bo kamai dekamai. Halo rif shepasak sof perak beis de'erivin v'iskimu imu rabim lefsok halacha b'chol makom ke basrai v'lo lachush kidivrei kamai. He says the rif himself articulates a principle which becomes very popular in Ashkenaz, and that is hilchasa ke basrai. If there's a debate between 14th century posek and a 13th century posek, we listen to the later posek because that person presumably had the benefit of knowing everything that came before. So there's this very important halachic principle, hilchasa kebasrai. We follow the later authority. Recency matters in the halachic discourse, and somehow we're going to be missing that if we only have the Beis Yosef. So that's going to be my contribution. I'm gonna tell you the poskim that are absent from the Beis Yosef's calculus. And he goes on and he says, we follow this principle of filu b'makom harav etzal tamid, even if you might have a debate between a student and teacher, v'chein pasku achronim tamid v'rosham maharik u'maharai b'tshuvosav ha'animos. You have all these poskim from the 13th, 14th century who use this principle, and we're going to use it. As well. And then he goes on to talk a little bit about the prevalence and importance of minhag, okay, which I want to return to in just a moment. So to put it in shorthand, right, the problems with the Beis Yosef are it doesn't account for a number of important poskim, okay, it doesn't account for later poskim, then the notion of hilchasa kebasrai, and it doesn't account for the minhagim of Ashkenaz. So let me say one word about this notion of Ashkenaz before we move on, because it's actually going to be almost indispensable. So the Rambam writes in many areas of halacha in which he comments that this is the minhag in our lands. Okay. The word Ashkenaz actually doesn't appear very often in his text. But I'll just give you one example of something that he says. This is one of literally thousands of examples of where the Rama says, I just want to let you know that minhag is important and minhag matters. This is one of the more kind of strident examples. You can see it here in source number 5 on your source sheet. So you all know that you get to shul on Yom Kippur night, and the Chazan says Kol Nidre, and the Shulchan Aruch writes Lel Yom Kippur Nogim Shomer Shliach Tzibur BeYeshiva Shamala BeYeshiva Shamata Al Das Hamakom BeAl Das Hakal Anu Matir Mispalim Avayanim Nogim Shomer Kol Nidre BeYachir Chomer Shechianu Below Kos. So you say this line of Al Das Hamakom, and then you say Kol Nidre, and then you say the brach of Shechianu. The Chazan makes all of those pronouncements. And now the Rama comments. This is actually in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, which we haven't talked about yet. But you'll see the importance of minhag. He says, "V'achar kach mispalim arvis v'nogim lomar kol nidre ve'odo yom." You say kol nidre when it's still daylight out. That's why we always move the calendar a little early, and everyone has to get to shul before Yom Kippur actually starts. Umamshich b'nigunim ad halayla, and there's all these tunes that you use until nightfall. The omrim oso shlosha pa'amim. The Chazan says kol nidre 3 times. V'chol pamag biakol yoser mibrishona, each time a little louder. V'chein omer hashatz gimel panim yislach l'chol adas. V'hakahal omer gimel panim yomer Hashem salachti kibarecha. And here's the line. It goes through the minhag. But al yishana adami minhag ha'ir afilu b'nigunim o b'piyutim she'omrim sham. Which is an amazing line. He says, don't change any city's minhag, even with respect to the tunes or the piyutim. Right? These are not halachic issues. Right? I say one tune, you say. He says, don't change the minhag. And this is going to be a trope for the Jews of Ashkenaz, and specifically for Rav Moshe Isserles. Okay. Now, let's just say as a kind of parentheses, unlike Rav Yosef Karo, who was preaching from a place of authority, literally from the land of Israel, right? He could say this is the way things are. Rav Moshe Isserles is in the Gola, right? He's in the diaspora. And to know how things are, how things should be, right? He feels responsible for preserving and maintaining the past, right? And Jews are exiled and they bounce around from one place to another. And if you're not careful about retaining what we used to do when we were in that other, right? Those practices he knows will be lost. So he reverts constantly to the practices of the Tosafot Ashkenazim from the previous centuries. And I didn't include it on your source sheet, but the Rama actually says in more than one place, right? You're not allowed to change any minhag, right? And you certainly can't decide that something is arbitrary. You have to treat minhag with the utmost authority. So now the question is, and again, I said I'd circle back to this because it's so important. We're saying there's a world of Sfarad and we're saying there's a world of Ashkenaz. So we have to define our terms. Just what are we talking about? And again, I'm actually not going to define Sfarad right now. But in the context of Moshe Isserles, what does it mean when we say that he's the posek for Ashkenazic Jewry? And I want to share with you 3 or 4 possible answers to this question based on a seminal article by a scholar named Joseph Davis. If anyone's interested, I'm happy to share the link. It's available. It's available online. What is Ashkenaz? How do you define Ashkenaz? So answer number 1 actually comes from the author of the Shulchan Aruch himself. For Yosef Karo, was once asked a question. There were a group of Jews who emigrated to a city that we'd not heard of, a place called Plevin. They had moved from Ashkenaz. And the question was, now that they're living in Plevin, where they have other customs, do they cease to be Ashkenazim, or do they maintain their Ashkenazic identity? And Rabbi Yosef Karo says, geography is decisive. If you don't live in, let's just say, Germany for now, right? If you don't live in Germany, you are not bound by Ashkenazic practice. Right? And if you live, the Beis Yosef would say, right, if you moved from, Krakow to the Sephardic community of Tzvat, so that's it. Put away your Ashkenazic sitter and put away your Ashkenazic minhag book and join us. You are now a member of the Sephardic community and act like a member of the Sephardic community. The definition of Ashkenaz, pull out a map. If you're in Ashkenaz, you're in Ashkenaz. And if you're not, you're not. Okay. I'll share with you a comment of the Erech HaLechem, who writes in source number six. Maybe in the interest of time, I'll just summarize it for you, but you could see it on your source sheet. The question is, there's a takana of Rabbeinu Gershom against polygamy. And the question is, to whom does that takana apply? Who accepted that that takana, and who did not? And the Erech Lechem writes that Rabbeinu Gershom's takana was accepted by certain people living at a certain place in a certain time. And those people are Ashkenazim, and their descendants are Ashkenazim. And if you stop someone on the street, that's probably the most common answer, you know, you'd get. Say, what makes you Ashkenazic? You say, oh, my grandfather was Ashkenazic, so I'm Ashkenazic. It's not a function of geography. It's a function of biology. Ashkenazim descends from a certain group of common ancestors. Now, there's another fascinating answer, which is actually referenced in a text on a title page of the Shulchan Aruch, which I've excerpted for you in source number six. Where we don't really know who put this together, but it's the editor of this text, and I'm not sure if you'll be able to see it. So this is a book that's published in Krakow in 1593. It's the Shulchan Aruch with the Ramaz inclusions, and the publisher writes here that I have the Shulchan Aruch by Rabbi Yosef Karo and the inclusions of the Ramah of Moshe Isserlis. So who's Rav Moshe Isserlis? Moreh Tzedek. Can you see this right under the words Moshe Isserlis? Moreh Tzedek. I'm not sure what the next word says. I think it says Minhag, Kehila, Kedosha, Polin, Raisin, Lita, Piha, Merin, the Ashkenaz. So who does the Ramah represent? The Ramah represents Poland, Russia, Lithuania, Moravia, Bohemia, and Germany. So, well, I don't know who decided that. But again, we're back to a specific geography that the Ramah is writing for his lands. And what do his lands mean? His lands mean very specifically Poland, Russia, Lithuania, Moravia, Bohemia, and Germany. And if you live in one of those places, so you are beholden to the psak of the Rabbah. Let me share with you two final answers to this question. One comes from a man called Chaim ben Bezalel, who wrote a very important book attacking the Rabbah. He's a contemporary of the Rabbah. They studied in the same yeshiva. He wrote a book called Bikuach Mayim Chaim. And he's famous because his brother was the Maharal of Prague, but he was a giant in his own right. And in the interest of time, I'll just share with you an English translation of an excerpt from the commentary and the excerpt to his work, which was an attack on the Ramah, he says, I have lots of objections to the commentary of Moshe Israelis, and I'll tell you what's chief among them. You can see in the original, in source number seven, here's the translation. There is a great need to assert the differences between the customs of Jews of Germany, B'nai Ashkenaz, and those of the land of Poland. Rabbi Israelis himself, in his introduction to Taras Chatas, did not mention the customs of Germany at all, but only those of his own land. The introduction of the proofreader, however, mentioned explicitly Poland and Ukraine, Bohemia, Moravia, and he extended borders even farther and wrote, and perhaps even places, every place where German is spoken by Jews. Maybe Ashkenaz is actually defined by Yiddish. If you speak the same language, then you belong to the Ashkenazic community. One may see that he expressed uncertainty whether the book applies to German Jews or not. So the printer added that on his own and mentioned Germany as well on the title page, that he would increase the sales of his books in those lands because buyers always look at the beginning of the book. So don't take anyone too literally or too seriously, right? It's not about geography. It's about common language. Now, he was very upset at the Ramah because he said it's very nice what the Ramah did to represent the Jews of Poland. But he totally forgot and totally neglected the Jews of Ashkenaz. We also have minhagim that need defending. So you read the Shulchan Aruch with the Ramah, and you get the impression that you have Sephardic customs and practices covered and Ashkenazic customs and practices covered. And B'chaim themselves is not true. You have Sephardic customs covered, and you have Polish customs. But that's not Ashkenaz. There's lots of us. And you also have the pride of place to what's happening in other regions and in other places. I'll share one final answer to this question of what constitutes Ashkenaz, which is perhaps the most stunning or the most unexpected. And it comes from a Shailos and Shuvos from a responsum of the Shar Ephraim, who was the grandfather of the Chacham Tzvi and the chief rabbi of the what's currently the city of Budapest. It was called Alt Offen or Budan in the second half of the 17th century, and he got there, a member of the Ashkenazic community, and he says, Shemiaz Mikedem, this is source number 8, Shemiaz Mikedem Shehai Katatus Merivus Bahal Begila Kedosha, Binyane HaPsakim, he says, there were all kinds of debates, because it was a Sephardic community, an Ashkenazic community, Matzasi Kasub Pinchas Kahal, Takanas Kadmonim Shekiblu Olehem, Kama rabbanim v'hitnu b'neim shelo yifsuku shum psak al pi tshuva upsakim min harishonim achronim im lo mashim v'huar b'tzur beis Yosef shulchan hatahor im achras bal hamapa umefarsheham achronim v'lo al pi shum posik acher. He says, I found in the Pinkas, in the community logbook of Budapest, that the rabbis got together and they had a conference and they decided, we go with the Ramah, which is a stunning thing to say, right? How do you know if you follow the Ramah? How do you know if you're Ashkenazic? They voted. If the community decided that that's how they're going to function, well, then that's how they're going to function. Okay. So a number of fascinating and different answers to the question of who is beholden to the Ramah. What does it mean to be Ashkenaz? Maybe it's because you live in a certain region. Maybe it's your ancestors that are decisive. Maybe you're descended from certain people. Maybe it's about the language that you speak, or maybe it's because a particular community votes on a particular matter and decides that they are going to adopt the practices of Ashkenaz. Okay. So we won't have time to get into the specifics, but the Ramah's most famous two works are the Darkei Moshe, which corresponds to the Beis Yosef. And now in every printed version of the Tur, what you have is the Tur in the center of the page and the Beis Yosef and the Darkei Moshe, right, in the column or below as the Sephardic and Ashkenazic accompaniments to the Tur. And next week we'll talk about this more. But in every version of the Shulchan Aruch, right, corresponding to the short, abridged, apodictic, conclusive statements of the Shulchan Aruch, you have the glosses of Rav Moshe Israelis printed right alongside them, right, to remind us and to let us know, yes, this is the psak of the Shulchan Aruch. This is Rabbi Yosef Karo said, he's the God of the door. We bow to him. But as Moshe Isserles wrote in his introduction to the Darkei Moshe, there are some deficits with a system that is reliant entirely on the Beis Yosef or the Shulchan Aruch. Principle among them, the problem that later poskim are unrepresented in these books, and principle among them, the problem that Ashkenazim and Ashkenazic Minhagim are so underrepresented in these texts. And it was the Ramah's life mission almost to correct this deficiency and bring back the pride of place, to restore the pride of place to Ashkenazic minhag and Ashkenazic practice. Before we run out of time, let me just show you a couple quick examples of Rav Moshe Isserles in action. Okay, I want to do a little learning with you before the clock strikes 2 o'clock. So if you have the texts, if you have your source sheets in front of you, jump with me for a second to source number 9, something from Hilchos Chanukah, something from Hilchos Purim. So in source number 9, this is, again, just to take you through a tour, a Beis Yosef and a Darkei Moshe. So remember, the Beis Yosef and the Darkei Moshe both agreed that they would, independently, they came to the same conclusion that they would attach, they would append their respective commentaries to the tour. The tour is still the centerpiece and becomes the pretext for the analysis and synthesis and commentaries of Rav Moshe Isserles and Rav Yosef Karo. So in Hilchos Chanukah, the tour wants to let all his readers know, what kind of fuel do you use for your Hanukkah candles? And he writes, the principle is, basically anything goes, kol hashmanim ha-psilos k'sherim la ben b'chol ben b'shabbos, anything you want. You could use paraffin, you could use oil, you could use whatever you want. Okay, af ha-psul l'ner shal shabbos, m'nei she'ein oran yafeh v'she'ein ha-shem nimshachar ha-psila k'sherim la delochei shinan shema tzichabeh. So there's certain things we don't use on Shabbos because we're worried that they're not really going to burn well, and somebody might lose track and they might want to relight it and it's going to be Shabbos and so on. So there's certain things that you wouldn't use for fuel on, for your Friday night candles. It says even those fuels which are not permissible on Friday night, you could use those on Hanukkah. It's not an issue. Beis Yosef in source number 10, and again, we're just making our way toward the Darkei Moshe. So Beis Yosef comments and says, yeah, kol hashmanim ha-psilos k'sherim la, ben b'chol ben b'shabbos, af ha-psulim ner shel Shabbos. He quotes the Torah. He says, pluksa demorai b'perek b'mei madlikin. This is an old debate from the Gemara on daf chaf aleph amud aleph in Shabbos. U'mashma b'gemara d'hilchasa kirav d'amar psilos hashmanim shamar chachamim ben lik b'hem b'shabbos, madlikin ben b'chanukah, ben b'chol ben b'shabbos. Seems like the Gemara concludes with the position of Rav, which is what the Torah said. Use anything you want, even if you wouldn't use it on Shabbos. It doesn't matter. In Hanukkah, you could use it. V'chein pasuk v'posuk. V'arokeach kasav shemen zayis mitzvah min ha-muvchar. And by the way, right, it doesn't even make it into the Torah, right? The notion that what is the optimal, you ask any school kid. So it's like the first thing they know about Hanukkah is you're supposed to use olive oil on Hanukkah. It's like a footnote in the Beis Yosef. By the way, the Rokech says, actually, good idea to use olive oil. That's the best. And the Maharam, he used to use olive oil too. Okay. Now you get to the Darkei Moshe. And the Darkei Moshe writes, he says, what we do here in Krakow is we use wax. And the Ashkenazic poskim say wax. We use candles. Deshaba mitzvah min ha-muvchar. Kimo b'shemen zayis. He says the Beis Yosef is telling you that wax, that olive oil candles are considered to be the creme de la creme in the pecking order of fuels that you might want to use on Hanukkah. And the Darkei Moshe pushes back. He says no, that's actually not the case. And it's not based on a halachic argument. It's based on facts on the ground. What we've been doing, you ask your grandmother what she remembers from, Krakow or wherever she lived before she got to Krakow at the beginning of the 16th century. And she's going to tell you, we Ashkenazim, we use wax. And if your grandparents, who were pious Ashkenazic Jews from the previous generation, were doing it, well, that means it must have been a good idea. And so the Rama writes that the best practice, equally good, he said you could use olive oil if you want, but equally good is the practice of using wax candles on Hanukkah. I'll just conclude, because Purim is right around the corner, and just to give you a snippet from Hilchos Purim in the Dark Emotion, source number 12. So every line that the Torah says and the Beis Yosef comments, every line the Dark Emotion just kind of jumps in and says, I just want to let you know, here's what we Ashkenazim do. Okay. And you wouldn't always know it based on reading the Torah and the Beis Yosef. Sometimes somebody mentions it, but the Dark Emotion, Johnny on the spot, always in defense of Minhag Ashkenaz. I'm just telling you what we do here in Ashkenaz. Okay. And a couple of quick examples. Source number 12, Bahagos Maimonios, Perak Aleph de Megillah, Kedamrin, Ati Eliyahu Zal, Ish Yehudi says we have this practice that there are four psukim in the course of the Megillah where the chazin, where the balkari stops, and everyone shouts out the psukim. They all read those psukim. Mordechai yatzal leyudim. I saw oraki. Mordechai yudi. Ve'ein tzel aminhag simcha be'alma shenagul ismoa chatinokos lazarzam kadei shiitnudaitam mitoch kach lishmoa kris Megillah. He says we do that. We do that to get the kids excited and to get them involved. And I want you to know about it. Okay. And the chazan needs to go back and read them. That's the minhag. Give you one more. This one is not as common. He says, Kasav Abu Draham Vizela Shano, Ksav Evan Yarche, Shinogim Bitsarfas Uprivansa. Okay, so now this is the Rama writing in Krakow about an old minhag that he's reporting from France and Provence. Shatinokos lokhin biadan avanim chalakim. What would they do? Kids would take smooth stones, bilichtob aleihem haman, and they would write on the smooth stone in chalk or something, they would write the word haman, and they'd bring the stones to shul. Kshemazkir hakara b'megillah, haman makishin zu alzu limchos eshemo. So maybe as an early grogger, but it was better than the grogger. Because what are you doing when you bang the stones together or you rub them together? In the course of banging those stones together, you are literally erasing the name of Haman. As the pasuk says, Limchos Hashemo, Shenemar, Vashem Yerushayim, Rishayim Yerkav. Okay, that the bones of the wicked should be crushed. Right. So you're like crushing the name of Haman. You're wiping out erasing the name of Haman, like you're erasing the name of Amalek. What an amazing minhag. And if you just had the tour, you might not know it. So Johnny on the spot, the Rama is there to report on and let you know about minhag Ashkenaz. In the last 60 seconds, I'll say one final word. There's something amazing that we talked about last week about the notion of a singular, single authoritative text where any Jew all over the world could open up and know what the halacha is. That's the Shulchan Aruch. That was his goal, and that was ambitious. But writing a book with one singular, authoritative, decisive, conclusive psak halacha for every Jew in the world also has the effect of flattening the landscape of the halachic system. So there's a cost, right? There's a cost because the texture and the nuance of local practice is erased. It's lost, particularly for Ashkenazim. So along comes the Rama, and he does this great service for the Ashkenazic Jewry of the world, and he restores the practices and customs to their rightful place and says, yes, yes, that may be so, but don't forget for one second what the Jews of Provence do and what the Jews of Poland do and what the Jews of Germany, wherever he gets the source of his minhagim. And for some, it wasn't even sufficient. There needed to be more. But here we have the great defender of the Jews of Ashkenaz, the minhagim of Ashkenaz, the practices of Ashkenaz. And there's really no substitute for the work of Moshe Isserles, and what a poorer work the Shulchan Aruch would be without his glosses and without the incorporation of the voice of Ashkenazic Jewry. Please God, we'll pick up next week with the conclusion of this series, and we'll discuss how the integration of the Ramah into the Shulchan Aruch played a key role in the formation of the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll discuss the other factors that contributed to the enduring nature of the Shulchan Aruch's authority for hundreds of years. I'm going to stop here, but happy to stay on and take any questions or comments. I'll begin with anything that that appeared in the chat. Okay, populations then, Israel, North Africa, Tehran, Central Europe, Western Europe. That's a great question. So you have to forgive me. I'm not an expert on 16th century Jewish demography. I will say that some of those numbers, you know, are estimated, but some of those numbers are just guesses, and it's hard to know. It's hard to know where the Jews were, how many of them there were. In any given moment. How available was olive oil in Poland in the winter? So that is a great question. And some scholars speculate that that is in fact, right, the basis for the use of other fuels. And particularly wax which would have been much more readily available. And that could have been what gave rise to the Ashkenazic practice of using wax rather than olive oil. Rubbing the stones together might cause a few sparks too. That is certainly possible. But always fascinating to hear about ancient Ashkenazic minhagim. Maybe some of them need to be brought back. Do the Ramah respect the Zohar like the Mechaber? So that's a great question. The Mechaber, for the Ramah, the Zohar plays a much narrower role. He was a Kabbalist, but there's almost there's precious few places that I can think of where the Ramah relies on the Zohar or other mystical texts in the halachic process. Great. Any other questions or comments?
A comment, a question. Did some of the Ashkenazi Menhagim might have a little bit of based on superstition?
In Poland, what do you have in means?
Poland? In Poland, because where my mother came from, and she had many superstitious things, but then I find that some of them have, in studying Torah, I find some of them do have some basis. It doesn't come to me in mind. It's just something I've noticed along the way.
Yeah. It's a great question. The scholars sometimes talk about like folk practices or folk beliefs. It's hard to know exactly where to draw the line. But I would say one important line of division when it comes to the authority of Minhag is a line between, on the one hand, old, veritable, and or widely accepted practices, and on the other hand, something which has less longevity and maybe less rabbinic backing. So when something comes from the general populace, it's not to say that it's not important, but it will often have less weight and less authority in the halachic discourse. And if something is then competing and there's another value, so that kind of minhag might give way, as opposed to something, we've always done it this way, the rabbis endorsed it, this is the real thing. That rises to a very high level, and the Ashkenazic poskim will take that very seriously.
Quick question. I noticed in going through your idea, especially in Basra Chalav and Isra Heter and so forth, sometimes the Ramah says, V'chein nohagin v'ein l'shanos, on occasion. I'm just trying to understand where, why he says that in some places. In other places, he's not as strident. He doesn't use his different verbiage. Is there some rhyme or reason?
It's a great question. And it's not just the Ramah. A lot of those formulations you'll find in Ashkenazic postgame, and specifically the Nosei Kelim on the Shulchan Aruch. I'm not aware of anyone who's kind of worked it through and figured out, exactly what each formulation might mean, with maybe one rare exception where there is an essay on this. But my suspicion is the Ein Lashanos probably is a little bit of a polemic, which is to say, somebody was agitating for a change or some kind of accommodation, and it's the Ramah putting his foot down and saying, this is the Minhag, and watch out. I don't want anybody to mess with it.
Thank you.
Would you say,
Doctor, you're muted. Okay, we'll see if we can get Dr. Heppner back. But in the meantime, I wish everyone a wonderful rest of the day and week, and I look forward to learning with you one more time in this series next week at the same time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon.